Accession number 17550, Reel 1.
Mr. Metcalf, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
Well, it was in Didsbury, Manchester, in 1914, January the 11th, to be exact.
Did you grow up and have your education in Didsbury?
No, no. I was 18 months old when my family moved to Liverpool. We had a house in Stonycroft. In 1922, we moved to Allerton in one of the first corporation estates. It was called the Economic. And they reckoned the houses would only last for 10 years. They're still standing today, incidentally, looking in quite good condition. And I was educated in, I've forgotten the school now, in Sefton Park. And started interested in radio in 1924 and built a first crystal set. My father built the box for it, and we received the Liverpool radio station, which was 6LV, operating from the arcade in Lord Street, which is now no more. I think the British Home Stores are there. And from there, I progressed. In 1928, built a transmitter. And made a transmission, which I learnt later was illegal. And a friend of mine received the signals about 400 yards away. I left school in 1928, became an apprentice radio engineer with cranes in Hanover Street. But the funny part about it, I knew more than the chap that was supposed to teach me. And we spent a lot of time winding and replacing gramophone springs in wind-up gramophones. Anyway, eventually they transferred me to one of their subsidiaries, the London and Liverpool Pianoforte Company in Granby Street. We used to go out doing service with a few coppers in our pocket for tram fare and a little voltmeter and an accumulator and an HT battery. And that was a total service equipment, repairing the few radio sets that were then in existence. In 1931, the subsidiary was closed down. There was actually a taxi crashed through the window and smashed the grand pianos there, and the cranes decided to close the branch down. And I was left without a job. There was the big hunger marches in Liverpool, end of 31, beginning of 32. Jobs were almost as scarce as they are today. And I was in town one day, saw one of the hunger marches going through, and I thought, this is enough for me. So I saw a very, very big hunger march come down past Lewis's along Church Street and Lord Street, and I thought, this is enough for me. I went up to London Road to the recruiting office and tried to join the Royal Signals, Royal Corps of Signals as it was then. And I was rejected medically as having a weak heart. So the same day, got on the overhead railway, which used to be called the Dockers Umbrella. Went up to Seaforth Barracks and was accepted for the Royal Corps of Signals. And a few days later, received a railway voucher and was on my way to Catterick. And that was my introduction to the Army. Arrived in Catterick on the 2nd of September 1932. And I met a chap there called Cyril Middleton, whose father was a jute waller in Calcutta, in quite a big way of business. And Cyril and I palled up then. We had a terrible shock on sort of the initiation into the army. We were given 3 coir mattresses, which were called biscuits, 3 blankets, a pillow, which was as hard as a rock, and a couple of sheets. And I can still remember how cold it was that night in Catterick. Anyway, we survived, and we did 3 months on the square, drilling, PT and all this sort of stuff. And I was selected for training as an instrument mechanic, and my friend Cyril Middleton became an operator, wireless operator. We had to do a couple of weeks in the mounted wing to learn how to ride a horse, and the introduction to that was, well, it was something certainly you'd never believe it today. None of us had ever really been close to a horse before. We were given 3 horses, one to ride with a blanket over and to lead the other 2. I think I got about as far as the stable gate and I was thrown off. Cyril got, well, he was on a different course to me, so he was on a different day, but he did make it through the gate before he was thrown off. Anyway, the long and short of it was we could ride a horse in some sort of a manner, went through the riding school. Then did our training. I went up to D Company in Catterick, did my training as an instrument mechanic, got fairly good marks, and eventually passed out, and I was posted to Army Fighting Vehicle Signals in Tidworth, and from there posted up to 4th Battalion Royal Tank Corps, believe it or not, back to Catterick again. Anyway, eventually I increased my trade qualifications and was selected for training as a foreman of signals.
As a what?
Foreman of signals, which is the chief technical NCO in the unit. And by that time, I was, before I actually did my training as foreman of signals, I was posted to India. I'd reached the dizzy rank of corporal by then. You had to have an NCO rank to train for a foreman of signals. Anyway, I arrived in India in 1935. I was posted to 3rd Indian Divisional Signals in Merritt, where the Indian Mutiny first started. We used to go on church parade with a rifle and 10 rounds of ammunition, or if you were armed with a revolver, you had 6 rounds of ammunition. In Merritt Church, in front of every pew, was a rifle rack. This was all relics from the Indian Mutiny. Anyway, from there I went down to Jabalpur, trained as former signals, and you automatically get promoted to company quartermaster sergeant, or as they now call them, staff sergeants. I did over 18 months on the Northwest Frontier. Oh, before that, and before the actual training as former signals, I went up to Quetta for a short time. Quetta is in Baluchistan, just after the earthquake, 4 days after the earthquake. And we were helping salvage bodies and rescue people. I rescued a little puppy dog who was with me for the remainder of my 10-year stay in India. Came back from Baluchistan, as I said, went on the former signals courses. Then I did over 18 months, nearly 2 years on the Northwest Frontier, mainly with Gurkha regiments.
Were you on active operations?
Oh, yes, yes.
Can you describe them, please?
Generally, very, very long marches, trying to subdue the tribesmen who were very restless. The Indian government, or rather the British government, through the Indian government, employed tribesmen to guard the roads. They were called Kathadars. And we had sangars built on top of high ground on mountains. A sangar was like a circle of stones, like a little fort, in a way. Once, when we were in Tal in Tochi, there was a lot of us having a swim in the Tochi River, and we were fired on from one of these guard posts, and they suspected it was the Kasadars. Anyway, the following day they came in and asked for some more ammunition as they'd engaged the tribesmen that had been firing at us. Well, the brigadier ordered the ammunition to be mixed with tracers. And sure enough, these tracers came over at us the following night. And I actually got hit in the heel of my chopley, which is a type of sandals we wore. It spun me round. It didn't do any personal injury other than a badly sprained ankle. It spun me round. They opened up the mountain battery on this Kasadar post and literally blew them to hell because the tracers were coming back at us.
Why should the Kasadars have done it?
Well, they were traitors. They had two masters. They were being paid by the Indian government, and they were loyal to their friends.
What date would this have been when you were wounded, do you think?
Ooh, I actually wasn't physically wounded. The bullet actually hit the heel of my choply and spun me over and sprained my ankle. What year was it? 1937. Can't remember the month. No, I'm sorry. There's quite a lot of things that associated with that operation. We were in Fort Spinwan, and we were surrounded with tribesmen that were firing at us. But one notable event I got was when an RAF plane came over and dropped the mail right in the fort, and there was a letter from my mother for me, and it was stamped to be dropped by RAF, which was most unusual, and I had that envelope for many, many years, and in the course of various moves it disappeared, but it would be quite unique, you know, if I'd been able to keep it. Another occasion, all the villages there, the houses are built with big watchtowers where they keep all the hens, chickens and anything else, you know. And as retribution, we were blowing these villages up because we knew the occupants had been causing disturbances. And with every brigade, there was a political agent, a PA, from the Indian government or the British government. And he wouldn't allow the brigadier to blow this village up because one of the men, tribesmen, was still in the house, and he wouldn't come out, believing that if he stayed there, they wouldn't blow it up. The political agent was called away, so the brigadier just gave the order to blow it up, hens, chickens, and the man. And that was that.
With artillery or what?
No, they set a charge underneath it and just blew it up. The artillery, the mountain battery, Royal Artillery, they were all Sikhs, very, very big men, very, very strong. They used to have mules, quite large mules. There used to be the wheels on one mule, the carriage on another, and the battle on another. I think the fourth one carried the some of the ammunition. And they could put these things together literally in under a minute. They were very, very quick. They just slotted together.
Which units of the Gurkhas were you attached to?
2nd 11th. Was it 2nd 11th? Oh, golly. I think it was. I'm not too sure now. So the 2nd 11th came instantly. It might have been. Yes, I'm a bit. It's in the dim distant past. You know, it over, what, 60 years ago, isn't it now? It's a long time. One funny, well, I can look on it now as funny, because I was being in charge of the workshops. I was with B Echelon, and they used to be with me. It was the MO and the Padre. And one day we were out, and the lunch we'd been given, sandwiches of very, very stale bread, you know. It was really almost impossible to eat. So I started feeding the crust to one of these mules. And I just turned round. The mule moved away and lashed out at me with its back legs. One hit my haversack, luckily there was a tin plate in, and it sent me flying, literally flying. And I can still remember the padre in the MO laughing like hell when they saw me, but I ended up with a very, very bruised buttock, on that. So the mule didn't appreciate my contribution to his meal. From there, I was posted to the WES, which was originally called the Wireless Espionage Section, and then somebody realised it was a stupid name because it told everybody what we did, and they changed it to Wireless Experimental Section. Now, this was in Sherat, in the Himalayas, north of Peshawar. If I remember rightly, it was about 40-odd miles away from Peshawar. From our mountain where we were located with the wireless station, receiving station, we could look down on the Khyber Pass. And in fact, I had one trip up through the Khyber Pass in the legation lorry, the British legation lorry, to take wireless equipment up to the British legation in Kabul. So I've been in Kabul, and there was all the legations, German and Japanese, every legation under the sun.
What were your impressions of Afghanistan then?
Oh, it's very wild. Very, very wild. Poverty is rife. In fact, I still puzzle out how they ever made a living, because the ground is not very fruitful.
Why had you gone to Kabul?
Just to take some wireless equipment and install it up there. And I did have a photograph, I think my son's got it now, of the dirt road with a signpost. The signpost shows bullocks one way and camels the other way. Oh, we used to have the camel ambulances up there with stretchers each side. Luckily, I never had to use one. Anyway, I was posted up to Sherat. We were an intercept. We used to intercept Russian stations. Listen, we had some quite good American equipment there. And it was there, well, sitting in my bungalow watching the sun setting over the Khyber Pass, that we heard war declared.
Were all these signals in code?
Pardon?
Were all the signals in code?
Yes, it was all coded. We were part of MI1B, and it used to go to MI10.
Were they easy to intercept?
Oh, intercept, yes. We read, it was all straightforward Morse. It wasn't Japanese Morse. They were just getting suspicious of the Japanese, and a lot of operators started training to read Japanese Morse signals. From there, we moved to Abbottabad, which was a very beautiful place near Kashmir, quite on the Kashmir border, and we had quite a big unit, and from there it became number one wireless company. The statute of limitations is all over at the moment, isn't it? We're well over the 50 years, I think, so I don't think I'm disclosing anything. And that's part of Y Group, what was then Y Group. It was a very large... We had another unit in Salafan in Palestine. In Abbottabad we had some high-speed equipment for recording north. There's Marconi HS1 high-speed equipment. And we used to get paid extra for decoding that. It used to come out on tape, undulators. And that used to be pulled across a typewriter and you just typed out the code. And we also had a large section of MI-10 cipher people with us. That was the introduction of the Typex machine, a very, very high-grade, sophisticated ciphering machine.
Why was it so high grade?
Because of its characteristics. It used to... you had five drums. I don't know whether I can tell you very much or whether I should tell you very much about it. But it's obviously been well superseded by now. And it was almost impossible. Yes, the Typex machine... we introduced it into India and I had to go up to Simla after that and teach the RAF people how to use it. From there I went down to Bombay and gave the Navy people 8 weeks' instruction on using it. Funny part about it, I had to learn it myself, which was, I just learned it from the manual. Anyway, that worked all right. There was one or two little instances in Abbottabad. We had... a transmitting station 4 miles away in Kakul that was controlled by landlines, copper overhead landlines. This was in the early part of the war. And metal coins, money was short. For distribution, and the Indian government introduced paper money. You got rupee notes in books similar to a book of stamps. You used to tear them off. Then we started losing whole bays of copper wire controlling the transmitters, and these were the loose wallers, the thieves. We had...
Which year was this?
Which year was it? 1940 it must have been. And we had a Gurkha guard patrolling the 4 miles, but they couldn't stop the loose...